Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the shadows of the Night Zone. This is Live Events. In the dead of night, when thy winter wounds shall not be healed from the wind which howls about your being. In the dead of night, when your friends have gone and you sit huddled by the castle's fire. In the dead of night, when all is dark, who will you be tonight? The following program is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. Although the Night Zone takes all precautions to bring you quality information, the Night Zone and its subsidiaries or affiliates do not accept responsibility for information provided by our guests or hosts. The Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered by our guests or hosts. We remind all of our listeners, KV at MTOR, ladies and gentlemen, your host, Colin Knott.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, madam and messieurs, boys and girls, mes enfants. Welcome to another edition of the Night Zone.
Tonight, from the shadows of the Night Zone, we bring you Torah Code 2012 with Richard Shaw, producer and the master of Planet X information, Marshall Masters. Next in the Night Zone.
Hebrew Torah is the oldest living, accurate wisdom text in the world today. How can you compare your results with the results that someone else is getting on the other side of the world? Well, with the Torah code, you can do exactly that. A divine being, a benevolent, wonderful divine being, could have woven this into the scripture. It's not beyond the possibility of doing that.
Your host, Colin Knight.
And indeed, tonight we shall investigate some very startling revelations buried deep within an ancient code. Now, recent revelations suggest a major Earth event is going to hit California within the next 30, 45 days, plus many more really accurate hits on past actions. Before we get to our guests, let's do some quick Night Zone housekeeping. Greetings going out to the Bricklayer's better half. Glad you found the show. Make sure you send me an email sometime. Hello to our special friends in British Columbia. Hope you are safe. And Sarah from Cardiff in Wales. Thank you for your kind words, my dear. Please continue sending guest suggestions. We are passing them on and seeing what we can do with them. And of course, our new listeners in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, home of the Calgary Stampede, the greatest outdoor show on earth. We are honored. You have made contact with us, and we hope that you enjoy tonight's show. To all of our listeners around the world, feel free to send an email to the show. Let us know how you're doing. Check the Night Zone webpage on blogtalkradio.com for contact information, or you can Twitter. I'm sure you'll find us up there, Night Zone 1. And after listening, please take time to rate the show on the Night Zone Blog Talk Radio site. Every listener does count. Tonight, we are digging into the Torah Code, its predictions for 2012, and startling information regarding upcoming Earth events, which will change our lives probably forever. Torah Code 2012 with Richard Shaw, producer, and Marshall Masters of the Colburn Bible. And good evening, Marshall and Richard. Welcome to the Night Zone.
Pleasure to be here. I always love being on your show.
I'm pleased to be here myself. Thanks so much.
And good to see you, Richard. Glad you can make it with us. Marshall, as you know, it's always a pleasure to have you back. And we're really, really pleased that Richard could take the time to bring his Torah Code on 2012. And it will tie in over the next 90 minutes. People will realize where the tie-in to all of this is. But you know, Richard, I'm not sure how you got hooked in with Marshall, but you didn't make a bad choice. So you are an independent film producer with Pinlight, is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, I it's a long story, but I kind of fell into this project. It was something that I was always interested in, and as a result of a kind of a serendipity plane ride that a friend of mine took, he unexpectedly ended up sitting next to Professor Robert Herelick from the City University of New York, the man who wrote the algorithm to search the Torah. And with that one plane trip, we were all connected with the world experts.
And isn't it, you know, they talk about the 5 degrees of separation, but when you start looking at things like that, is that a coincidence that you happened to be by his side? I doubt it.
No, I don't think so. It was amazing. I mean, we just had a simple discussion one afternoon. I said, you know, my friend's name is Lee. He lives here in Hollywood. And I said, you know, I've always been interested in the Bible code. It's really kind of a misnomer. It's really the Torah code. And I said, but someday I would like to do a documentary about it. And that was the end of the discussion. Next thing I know, he's sitting next to the professor that wrote the software. So it was pretty amazing. I was stunned.
It's called synchronicity. Yeah. It's the magic that makes things. You know, it's just think about it. It's like you think about someone and then the phone rings, right? How many times has that happened in your life? And it's like, we really do. There is that. This really goes back to, I mean, those of you who've seen The Secret or What the Bleep Do You Know, and you're talking about if you're sending out that request, the universe has this way of going, oh, okay, well, here it is, plop.
It does seem to work that way.
And then meeting Marshall was something I didn't really expect. I was trying to find people that had intriguing information about 2012, and I liked what Marshall was doing on YouTube, and just wrote him an email one evening saying, hey, I would love to have you on this program that I'm producing. And I got a phone call at midnight, and it was Marshall, and we must have talked for how long, Marshall, an hour?
Gosh, I think it was close to 2 hours.
Like,
you know, we both turned into pumpkins. It was that long.
Well,
we were both
definitely... It definitely came together, and from what I have seen from the trailer on the video production, I got to say, Torah Code 2012 is something that I'm definitely going to be looking at. But let's lay down some background here, guys, because there are a number of people already twittering regarding what is the Torah Code. Now, this was first discovered in the 80s by Professor Ripps, correct?
The computer version of it was, yeah, but the actual history of the Torah and its discovery goes back for centuries, many centuries, clear back to the Vilna Gaon in the 12th century, who believed that there was something more in the Torah than what met the eye. It progressed through the centuries to Sir Isaac Newton, who spent 20 years of his life looking for a code in the Torah. He found a bunch of interesting things, but he didn't find the real key to digging the code out of the Torah. That didn't happen until in the 30s when Michael Weiss Mendel, who was a mathematician and a rabbi, decided to pick up the idea. And even as a teenager, he was writing the letters to the Torah down on 3x5 index cards and trying to look for patterns. Well, then World War II came. He was hired by the Allies to help search for the Enigma code, the famous German code that was so hard to crack, and was actually responsible for helping to solve that. So he was a brilliant mathematician. His family was murdered in Auschwitz, and after the war, he managed to survive, and he ended up in New York in the 50s, and that's really where he discovered the key to searching the Torah code with equidistant letter sequencing, ELS.
Now, 30 years later,
when Professor Ripps put it into a computer, and that's the beginnings of what we have today.
Right. Right. Now, in the 80s, switching over to a computerized system, did it confirm what the people previously had found, or did it find another route of information? Do you know?
No, it did. Professor Ripps and I have talked quite a bit, and he's a brilliant mathematician and renowned all over the world. He's a world-class mathematician. And he's basically using the same key that Rabbi Weissmandel did in the 50s, but he supercharged it by help getting basically computer software that was written in the mid-80s, right after the advent of computers, and they put the entire Torah text into the computer, and then they can actually type in keywords in Hebrew, and the computer will find it inside of the Torah text. That's how it actually began, and since then, the technology has really been streamlined.
Right. Now, on previous shows, we've looked at the Bible code and its prophecies, and of course, examined Revelations and Matthew and John. What is the difference between the Bible code and Torah code?
Can I take that one?
Sure, Marshall. Sure.
Okay. Let me talk to it, because I come to this project. I was in the computer industry for over 2 decades. My client list included AT&T, Oracle, Sun, Hewlett-Packard, Lockheed Martin. And so when I look at what they're doing, I see it as a technologist. And I see a very scientific, extremely precise method. And where a lot of people really start with this is they think about the 1998 book by Drazen, Bible Code. And that really was what brought this out to everyone's attention. And the Torah code, that is really where the codes are found, is in the Torah of the Old Testament, as Christians call it. But as a technologist, what I'm looking at more is, well, what is it that the computers are doing? Because bear in mind, the actual first computing engines were used to break the Enigma code. They had very sophisticated, right, in those days, very sophisticated engines. But when Drazen did his book in 98, compared to what these researchers are using now, and think about it, instead of talking about computers, because the terms can really get geeky, easy thing to do is think about what were you using in the way of cell phones in 1998, and what are you using for a cell phone today? I mean, cell phones of 1998 were first generation. Okay, they were the old analog sets. Today, we're now going into fourth generation, all right? And you literally can hold in your hand a device that is several times more powerful than the desktop PCs that were available in 1998. And so when you look at Drazen and then you look at what the researchers are doing today, it's literally like going out and comparing a Model A Ford to a brand new Lincoln Continental sitting on the showroom floor. I mean, the technology difference is that huge. And so when I looked at it from a computer technology standpoint of what they're doing, I was deeply impressed. I mean, there's the code where it's cloud computing, parallel computing, and so forth. But the amount of power that they're doing, and then how they're using the power is important. The manner in which they are finding these tables is really no different now than what Drazen was doing in 1998. And you could go out and buy a program for just a few dollars and do the same searches yourself. What they're doing, which is it's many levels above, is the vetting process where they're going in and saying, you know, how unique are these tables, statistically speaking? And this is what has really given them the strength to come back on the old Hackney attacks from 1998, that they, well, you can find this in Moby Dick, or you could find it in Gone with the Wind, and what have you. And what they've done is they've used all of this state-of-the-art technology to shoot down that argument. So what Torah code really presents for the debunkers and the cynics is a nightmare, because they don't have an easy way to attack it. Yeah. Right. So that's really the big difference.
So the Torah code is actually a concentrated code of the Bible Old Testament.
It's a highly validated code. In other words, when you're looking at the Torah code tables that are coming out of Jerusalem, they set an incredibly high threshold on this. All right. What is the statistical uniqueness, if you will, of these tables that they're finding? And, you know, there's an old term that the debunkers like to use, monkey text. And the researchers in Jerusalem use the same term. And what they're really saying is, look, we'll clean our own house. And they will go in and take a look at things. They took all of the tables in Drazen's books, and many of them do not meet the criteria for veracity that the Torah code researchers are using today. I mean, when they finally say, okay, this one has veracity, this is a fully tested table, I mean, they have really beat on it pretty hard. Yeah, you know, whereas so, before, that process wasn't there.
Right. So how old is the Torah code, Richard? How far back does it go?
Well, the Torah code had to be encoded when the Torah was given, so it's roughly about 3,322 years old this year, which is kind of the amazing thing about it. So it makes you wonder, well, how could the Torah text have been encoded all of those centuries ago, and now we're reading stuff about the BP oil spill in the Torah code? I mean, it's pretty fascinating, to say the least. We've got some tremendous tables that have been found in the Torah that talk about current events, people, places, disasters, and then simple things in people's lives are sometimes indicated. It's just like, why is that in there? And going back to what Marshall was saying, the one key that they didn't have because of the technology in the 90s was the ability to really prove the tables from a statistical sense. And that's what Professor Haralick was able to bring to the table, because part of his expertise was in probability. So the way that they do these, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, the way that they do that is they check a table using the same protocol against up to 100,000 other Hebrew texts as a test. And then they can get a p-value and find out how significant the table is. And that's why they have all this big computer equipment.
Right. Do we have any technology today that could create an identical style of Torah code? Do we have that ability mathematically to create something as pure as the Torah code?
Not that I know of. I mean, it's amazing that you can read stories in the Torah, you know, Jacob and Joseph, and throughout the book of Genesis, and all the things that happened in the Torah, and never realizing that underlying all of that is a whole other set of information that happens to be there. And like going back to Weissmandel again, I have to do that just because just to prove that the code is there, he was just finding these things by counting with his finger without a computer or any fancy equipment at all. He'd be able to skip, okay, I want to skip every 50 letters, and oh, look at that, I got the word Torah. I wonder if it happens in this book. And then he started seeing patterns. And so he found an incredible amount of things just by counting, but it was just too arduous in those days, and it took a computer to really open up the Torah code for us.
Right. So
what I wanted to say, though, is that going back to the question you asked, do we have the ability to create? I think what your question really is do we have the ability to create a hoax like this? So, and it's an important question. I'd like to address that.
Absolutely.
No, we do not have the ability to do something like that, because what the Torah code is, it's a multidimensional database. We see it on a sheet, on a scroll, and we see it two-dimensionally, all right? And it's more than three dimensions. And the reason why I'm saying that is that you have alignments of characters that are following in date sequencing, and there's no way to really know until you're at that point in the present right. timeline that you can ask the intelligent questions. To me, it's an incredible navigation tool to say, is this the timeline we're on? And you could project just a little bit ahead and you could ask intelligent questions. But in terms of how the information is stored, a good way to think of it is, You know, go back to the old way that they used to make cartoons, you know, like Betty Boop and Popeye
one
and that
feature,
stuff.
One page at a time. The old flick cartoons, right?
Well, not a little bit more than that. I mean, you know, like when Snow White, and I probably should have said that, when Disney was really getting going, and what technology made that possible, all right, was something called a light box. And a light box was you had multiple layers where they could put Mylar sheets, and they would paint different elements. And so there would be, you'd have a character, then you'd have your trees, then you'd have your grass and whatever you're doing. And then all they had to do is they wanted to create that story was change one of the layers. And then when they would actually shoot that, you're looking down on top of that. What you're seeing is all of those are compressed together. And it looks like it's just one layer. But actually, you have several layers of information, and they're all being manipulated and moved back and forth so that,
right,
you know, one character can move, a tree can fall, things like that.
Right.
And this is the way. Think of it like when you go to the amusement park. And you want to have your picture with Elvis, right? And there's a cardboard Elvis. And everyone stands around the cardboard Elvis. And when you take the picture and print it and take it home, it looks like you're really standing next to Elvis, right? And so there's that two-dimensional aspect that is created. It's almost a false front image. There's more to it than that. Same thing with the
right.
Torah code. I think it's dimensions deep.
Yeah, the reason I brought that question up is very simple. How 3,000 years ago did someone have the mathematical ability to impregnate the storylines in the Old Testament in such a precision when we don't even have that capability today? To me, that's almost a divine intervention.
Or extraterrestrial.
Yeah, or exactly. Well, you know, either each hand or say it the way you want to say it, I guess. But yeah,
mm-hmm.
And so that's where I'm coming from. And that's why I threw the question in there, because if we do not have that ability to create that perfect of a code, then how in heaven's name with a man with a scribe could manage to conjure this up in as much as it has over, you know, over the time. I think it's fascinating. So I tell you what, guys. Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I just said that it wouldn't have been possible, but it is interesting that there may have been a technology at play to pen the Torah, because we read about unusual things clear back in the Book of Enoch, where it talks about a reed of quick writing, something that allowed Enoch to write 360 books in the space of 30 days of a month. And also in the Midrash, which is an ancient Jewish text, it talks about the Ten Commandments being inscribed on sapphire plates, the original ones that Moses broke. And you look at that and you go, how is that possible? Because sapphire has a hardness factor of 9, which is just less than a diamond. So
right.
I'm thinking that there's a lot more about the writing of the Torah than we have ever were given any information on.
And
yeah,
that's exactly where I'm coming from, is that there's something is out of whack with our history, or something is out of whack with
everything.
I think we're very groomed when it comes to history as to, you know, we get the party line. Okay, and there's a lot more to history. When I look at this, and you know, and this is a question in my mind of who could have created this. And one of the things that intrigues me is the possibility that, let's say this is created by an entity, multidimensional entity, and for this entity, time travel is, all time is current. You know, to us, our perception of time really is primitive. It goes back to when sailors were dragging, you know, wood behind the ship, knotted wood on the ship so that they could see what their speed was and timing it. So we have a very naval view of time, but a species that could travel anywhere and travel through dimensions, they could see that. And but the question in my mind that leads me is, if they could see that, are they seeing different possible timelines and variations of timelines, or
exactly.
Is there just one?
Is there only one? And, you know, they say there can only be one, and only being one, Marshall, I tell you, we have to do a break.
We're in the night zone on blogtalkradio.com.
In a matrix, a tight matrix like you're talking about, you can find Twin Towers, Bin Laden, destruction, different words. I find that sort of beyond coincidence.
Not much question at all what there's life throughout the universe. We're not alone in the universe at all. No, for sure we're not alone.
Fly by the comets, visit asteroids, visit the moon of Mars. There's a monolith there, a very unusual structure on this little potato-shaped object that goes around Mars once in 7 hours. When people find out about that, they're going to say, who put that there? God put it there.
I spent 28 years working for the United States Department of Defense, the National Security Agency, where I was a senior project mathematician and cryptanalyst. Or, in other words, a professional code breaker.
Torah Code 2012. Next, in the shadows of the Night Zone. Night Zone Radio is a research tool for those who wish to investigate, understand, and become informed on paranormal activity. The following information is presented in good faith as we continue to seek the truth, thinking outside the box. And we remind all listeners, KVNM Tor.
Program was originally aired live long before the advent of high fidelity. As a result, many detection phrases and transmission problems so common to old radio. We hope, however, that any variance in audio quality will not take away from your pleasure.
For as the lightning comes forth from the east and shines as far as the west, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. Your host, Colin Mack.
Not much question at all, but there's life throughout the universe. We're not alone in the universe at all. No, for sure.
A year ago, and what we know today, it is like the difference between the kindergarten and university.
And I listened to that last piece of that soundbite as we were coming back in there, and the professor was saying that the information that we knew a year ago is like being in kindergarten compared to what we know today being in university. And I think that's such a powerful statement.
Yeah, that's Rabbi Glazerson. He's an expert in the Torah and in the Kabbalah and a lot of ancient Jewish texts. He just finished a book on 2012. He's a great guy.
Right. Has the Torah code been run on a supercomputer yet? And what did we kind of get out of that mix?
Oh, sure. You can. There's commercially available software that people can run the Torah code on themselves. What they won't be able to do is do real probability checks with it in the way that the professors can, because they're using something called a cluster computer. They can run tests that would take a normal computer 300 days, and they can do it in 8 days.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. That's a pretty powerful system, Marshall. Are the variances like within real tight tolerances? Are they exact, or what's going on around the world?
Well, I mean, the cluster computing that they're doing is a good way to imagine it. If you just were to go to Wikipedia and type cluster computing, and you'll see a huge bank of Silicon Graphics cluster computers at NASA. And actually, I saw NASA over a decade ago going in this direction. They get, you know, everybody thinks about the huge mainframes like the Whopper from that movie.
Yeah.
But really, yeah. Now what they find is so much more powerful. They take a lot of smaller machines and they hook them together. And literally everything just nibbles away. I mean, the best way to think of it is that, you see
in
nature
films. Second, Marshall. I lost you there for a second. I lost you there for a second, my friend.
You got me?
We got you back. Yep, we got you back. Go ahead, sir.
Good way to think about a cluster computer is, you know, when you see in the nature movies and the ants come swarming to the grasshopper, and next thing you know, you got 1,000 ants eating the same grasshopper and it disappears real fast?
Right.
That's how cluster computing works. It's like 1,000 ants eating a grasshopper. And so, I mean, the stuff that they're doing, I think that particularly, you know, again, finding it, you can use an old relic that you still got in the garage and you can find stuff just as fast as they're finding it in Israel. The difference is where you're going to say, okay, is this thing, does it meet the threshold? Does it meet the test? All right. You know, not only does it talk the talk, but does it walk the walk statistically? Yeah. And that's where the cluster computing really comes in. What it does is it is the most powerful way yet to date to give us confidence in the tables that are being discovered. Confidence that was never before possible. And I think the confidence factor is really the big difference between Bible code and Torah code. But, you know, Bible code, you know, even though it had that older technology, let's not forget it had some big wins. And that's the reason why that book really took off. It predicted an assassination. And so, and one of the things that, you know, we did, we looked at that, and particularly like the earthquake codes for Los Angeles that were the tables that were printed in Drazen's book, and looking at that, and then other things that are coming to pass. So what it does, though, is that that big thing is that when we see a Torah code, and when the researchers will finally take that preliminary caveat off of it and say, okay, we've run the whole test on it, and it stands, right, and you know, you have really high confidence in that,
and
what you
with
want.
This, right, with this code, now my understanding is it is correctly recorded issues with Barack Obama, the Mumbai massacre, the stock market crash, and also some future events of 2012. These are already known to the code breakers, am I correct?
That's correct. It's been something that some of these things we've been working on for a number of years, and now we're starting to collect tables from all of them. The LA earthquake prediction was something that was a request that the people that were reading my column in the Examiner had read that table in Drazen's book and wondered if it was still valid. And so we picked it back up, and the professors have taken it apart and made a new table using those same keywords.
I see. Okay. Well, my understanding is that it's easier to find a code of an event that has happened rather than a future event.
That's correct.
But the new discoveries are giving us more of a window into the future as well as into the past. So how have we managed to change that around, Richard? How has that been possible? Is it because of the computing power?
I think it's helpful, but I know that none of the professors will tell you that the Torah code should be used for making predictions, because the only reason is because we just don't know enough of what to ask it. A good example of that is when there was a table made, I think even by Michael Drazen, about when the presidential election occurred in 2000, and if Al Gore was going to be president, and the Torah code came up and said, yes, Al Gore president, it said. Well, you know, he was like for a few minutes, but then what no one looked for in the Torah text was alongside that same line of text, and Professor Rips and I looked at this in the actual Hebrew that came up in that table, and it says, he thinks maybe. Now, no one would have known at that time to put in a search term that said he thinks maybe would be president. But that's what was actually in the Torah. So we don't, our predictions can be faulty if we don't know what to ask and what our keywords are. And the keywords are supposed to be a priori, which means chosen in advance, so that you're not just snooping for words, but you're trying to find words that are significant. So we do the best we can, but there can be mistakes, and it would be human error more than computer error.
It would be, but I would say one thing that I am observing, particularly with the team, is that, Colin, this is a heuristic process. You learn through trial and error, and you improve your skills, and that's the way we do most things. And this is a hero. Imagine, you know, you've got a jailer's key ring with 100 rings on it, right? Or 100 keys on it. And then the more often you're sorting through all of those keys on the ring, the faster it is to find the right ones. And it's just something that comes through trial and error. And you know, okay, does that key work? You stick it in, you turn it. Yeah, it works. And you remember that. And then you refine your skills as you go along. So I think that what we will see over time is that this research is going to start producing a greater volume of tables based on current events. And that is exactly what's happening. I mean, I almost... to be honest, guys, sometimes I don't want to check my email, you know, because Richard go, here's the newest table, and I'm going, oh, thanks, you just made my day, you know, and because a lot of the stuff that's coming up, and they're talking about this embargo ship that tried to, you know, that tried to run the embargo in Israel. That stuff is mentioned. They're talking about a possibility of us now getting into a global war, and that includes the use of nuclear. And, of course, this really, you know, some people say, well, gee, you know, what proof do you have of that? And I'm going, well, why don't you just watch CNN, see how much time they're devoting to Iran and Pakistan and their bomb-building programs?
Are you still getting royalties for saying CNN? Because
no.
I'm just wondering, Marshall, because, you know, like, yeah, but I do agree with you 100% that there is something is afoot. And here at the Night Zone, the plan is very, very simple. We bring all of the facets of the diamond together and see mm-hmm. what this diamond looks like, because every area of the paranormal and the supernatural has a story, yet the Torah code 2012, it is a locked in 3,000-year-old manuscript that is without doubt a code and is there and exists. It hasn't been manipulated or changed by man. We don't have the technology to do that. Therefore, mm-hmm. if all things being equal, this is pretty darn legit.
It is, you know, and I think of it in light of all of the things that are now coming to pass. I mean, the book I published, Colburn Bible, what really made that possible was the invention of the Internet. Think about it. Before the Internet, you know, I lose track of all the unpublished books of the Bible, right? And Richard mentioned the Book of Enoch. We have the Book of Mary. We have a lot of these texts that are now finding their way out into the public. And the reason why they're doing that is that it is, in this electronic age, it is incredibly difficult for vested interests to quash and kill this information.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's really coming out. And I think the harbinger event for all of this that enabled what we're seeing here was actually Tiananmen Square. And because there you had a case of the most repressive government in the world at that time, could not stop the hemorrhage of simple email messages, faxes, phone calls coming out of, you know, Tiananmen Square. And the world could see. We have that picture of that young fellow that stood in front of that column of tanks and stopped them. That is the power of the Internet. That's the power of the communication age. And so to me, a lot of these mystery texts that are now coming out into the light of day, that's enabling them, just as it's enabling this work on the Torah code. And
I agree, Marshall. I mean,
high degree of confidence.
The famous verse in Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. And I don't know how you would seal a book unless you encoded it in
That's
a way
right.
that, you know, would have some information that would be available when we need it and only at that point in time. And I told Professor Rupps last time I saw him, last time I was in Israel was in 2008. And it was a little bit depressing because I was just walking by this crumbling ruin and that crumbling ruin and this set of old stones from some temple. And this, and I was talking to God and saying, where's our thing for our time? And it just dawned on me, it's the Torah code. It's only for this particular generation because no other generation would have had the technology or the people that would know how to do it. We've just kind of fallen into this, and it's very exciting.
And
it
speaking
is.
Of and speaking of not having the technology,
you are in the night zone on blogtalkradio.com.
We'll be right back.
Ancient Sumerian text, just in a very broad overview, basically tell us that these Anunnaki came from space and landed on the Earth in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. They began to set up a colony that they called Eden. Welcome to the shadows of the night zone.
In a matrix, a tight matrix like you're talking about, you can find Twin Towers, Bin Laden, destruction, different words. I find that sort of beyond coincidence.
There's not much question at all, but there's life throughout the universe. We're not alone in the universe at all. No, for sure we're not alone.
Fly by the comets, visit asteroids, visit the moon of Mars. There's a monolith there, a very unusual structure on this little potato-shaped object that goes around Mars once in 7 hours. When people find out about that, they're going to say, who put that there? God put it there.
I spent 28 years working for the United States Department of Defense, the National Security Agency, where I was a senior cryptologic mathematician and cryptanalyst. Or, in other words, a professional code breaker.
Torah Code 2012, next in the shadows of the Night Zone. Night Zone Radio is a research tool for those who wish to investigate, understand, and become informed on paranormal activity. The following information is presented in good faith as we continue to seek the truth, thinking outside the box. And we remind all listeners, KVMTOR.
Program was originally aired live long before the advent of high fidelity. As a result, you may be facing a crazy transmission problem so common to old radio. We hope, however, that any variance in audio quality will not take away from your pleasure.
For as the lightning comes forth from the east and shines as far as the west, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. Your host, Colin Mack.
Not much question at all, but there's life throughout the universe. We're not alone in the universe at all. No, for sure.
A year ago, and what we know today, is like the difference between the kindergarten and university.
Like kindergarten and university. Is there anybody out there? Are we all alone in this universe? It's looking more and more possible that we have a crowded lifestyle and we just don't see it. I have with me tonight Richard Shaw, producer. For a very interesting video and a very interesting project that Richard and Marshall Masters have put together, Torah Code 2012. Quite fascinating. Now, guys, normally I would be moving on with some other issues, moving with Planet X and yourself, Marshall, but I've had a couple of callers hanging on the line that I've stacked up here. And we're going to try this. Normally, I wouldn't take calls during these interviews, but I'm kind of curious. 323, you are on the air. Your geographical location, first name, please.
Oh, it's Lee.
Hi,
it's
Lee.
Lee.
Hey, how are you? I'm an old friend of Rick's. I actually was the person riding on the plane when I met Herrlich by synchronicity.
Impressive. Impressive.
Oh, yeah. Hi.
My father was a great biblical scholar and lectured at Oxford and et cetera. And when he read Drosnin's book the first time, he bought 10 copies. I actually found him in his library wrapping them in brown paper to send them to friends. But my comment to Marshall and you, Colin, and Rick, is that to me this whole thing seems like a very organic human synthesis. It's almost prophetically kinetic in the sense that you begin, like Rick pointed out, very old story, 13th century, comes up through Weissmandl in the 1950s, and then it attracts persons as ultimately diverse, I mean incredibly diverse, as Drosnin, who was a Washington Post, Wall Street Journal writer, and later Sadenover, which I think is important to mention because he wrote Cracking the Bible Code, who was also a very unusual character, a psychologist and although also a scientist. I think he was a visiting lecturer at King's College. But then it attracts people like Harold Gans, Rips, Eliyahu Rips, Robert Herelick, people that came from, in the case of Rips, very interesting story because they come from agnosticism or atheism to a belief in something bigger because of their discoveries in the code. So it really has, and Marshall pointed this out, gain momentum through time, and it's a fascinating study.
It's almost as if the divine hand came down and touched their shoulder, isn't it?
It is,
come from total atheism to discover a code in books that they had no passion over, to suddenly mm-hmm. realize the passion and the love they had for the document they were tearing apart by code. Amazing.
Completely, and I think the debunkers have been falling by the wayside, the monkey texters, not that they're text messaging, but the debunkers of it have fallen by the wayside, and converse to that, which is really interesting or juxtaposed, is that people that would be debunkers of it, case in point, Harold Gans, who is cryptologist at the Department of Defense, his whole point of coming to the code was to disprove it. He was completely convinced that in a few days he could, you know, put this to rest and this would be gone. And he became one of its most devout adherents. So as the debunkers have fallen by the wayside, people that have come from complete skepticism have actually been attracted and become part of what is now known as the Torah code kind of study, and that's a remarkable fact. That's absolutely correct.
That is fascinating, Lee. Thank you very much. I appreciate you,
you
coming online, sir. And
thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Well, look at that. You see, anybody can step into the night zone when you least expect it, guys. But isn't that fantastic information? So, Marshall, how does the Torah code? And I'm getting this from our virtual studio. What does the code say about 2012? What's going on there?
Well, that was the point at which I came into the project. And one of the things that we did after I first met Richard, I was down in Los Angeles doing a segment for History Channel. And we got into it, and I said, okay, what is it you want from me? And he said, Planet X 2012. They're interested, just curiosity. Give me keywords. And so I got with my research group, and we made up a long list of keywords that they could just translate into Hebrew and punch in. Now, one of the tables came up, and it was a pretty good hit, and it was 2013 Nabiru. And that was really important for us because one of the things that we've always been maintaining is that to us, 2012, if you think of it as a concert, 2012 is the warm-up band. 2013 is when the headline act appears. And that's the worst of it. Well, that's really what the Torah code is saying. I mean, as I was working with Richard on this and the researchers, what was coming back was that there's very little mention of Planet X or Nibiru, which is the Aramaic pronunciation of it, was popping up for 2012. I think there was just one occurrence. But then there was one table that comes in, and it's like a perfect upside-down T, 2013 Nibiru. And here in the West, we spell it Nibiru, because that's how it appears. And Sitchin set the style on that, because it's just easier in the West to pronounce Nibiru as opposed to Nibiru. And, okay. But the other things that is showing, what we're really finding is, 2012 is what the codes that are coming back, the tables I'm seeing out of the groups are saying, it's a year of atonement. And again, that was really consistent with what we've been feeling all along and seeing in our own independent research. I mean, up until the time I met Richard, to me, Torah code was just something. It was, and to be honest, I was more skeptical than anything else. But when he started getting these things where it was actually correlating perfectly with what we were seeing in our own secular research. We follow those fringe lunatics at NASA and these other places.
Right.
We glean their data, and then we're just looking for the things that we are looking for. And that is, in that year of atonement, that's 2012 is when we know the guacamole is hitting the fan. We're not going backwards. And it's a year of atonement. It's a year when people are just really going to be saying, wow, we just have got to rethink how we live our lives and what we're doing. And but that's already starting to happen for some.
Let me jump in here, guys. We've done a lot of tables on 2012, some of them which we don't want to reveal yet until the film comes out. But there is one that I got from Professor Haralek, and normally his p-values are really good. This one is like 0.00250.
You might want to explain p-values.
P-value is basically where they are comparing how many hits the table gets against all of the monkey techs. So say that you're checking that one table for accuracy against 100,000 other techs, and it comes up X number of times. And it all depends on the table how many times it would appear. But, if it gets less than 20 or 30 hits out of 100,000, then that's a pretty significant table.
Right.
So you could say the lower the number, the higher the confidence.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
And it also changes by the number of monkey techs that you're running it against. It just depends how much time they have on the computer. But I have one here that says Tevet 8, which is December 21st. In 5773, that is the Hebrew year for 2012.
Right.
It actually could be considered 2013, but since there's an overlap in the two calendars, and it's December 21st, the Hebrew year is actually a year ahead of us, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
It's the Hebrew year changes in September. And then the keyword purification, and then the phrase of the earth. So I have one here that says December 21st, 2012, the purification of the earth. That's one of the 2012 tables that we ended up with amongst several. Yeah.
Now I heard you talk about throughout the night here, I've heard you talk about monkey text. What is monkey text?
A monkey text would be like any normal unencoded text, like Moby Dick, War and Peace, Hebrew text of a significant length. I mean, there's over 304,000 characters in the Torah, so you'd have to test it up against an equal length text.
Gotcha. Okay, now I understand, because I'm thinking, monkey, you're being texting? What am I missing here?
right.
You gotta bear with me, guys. I'm still trying to come up to speed with all of the Torah code, and the more I am reading, the more the Holy Bible seems to unlock. There seems to be more relevance to what they have written, and this concerns me excitedly. But then I look at the volcanoes spewing around the world, and the war, and the AIDS virus, and all of the plagues, and I have to question, when you say purification, Richard, to what level of purification do you think that would be?
I don't know, and I'll bet that Professor Haralek might have taken his cue from the phrase from the Hopi Indians, who believe that's what's going to happen in 2012. And there's cultures all over the world that believe something is going to happen in 2012. Nobody knows what. But heaven knows the earth needs to be purified at this point with the beefy oil spill and all of the radiation and all of the other things that are all over the earth. Something massive needs to happen. This is one reason I've been always been interested in the book, in fact, that Lee introduced me to. It was the book Worlds in Collision by Emmanuel Velikovsky, which was written back in 1950. And it basically is more or less a Planet X scenario, hypothesis, that something like that has happened to the Earth many times before, which is why I really wanted to talk to these professors to see what they felt about 2012. And in our first discussion, they'd never heard of it. They didn't know what 2012 was. So when they started looking into it, the tables that they began pulling up, now this was mostly at the time, Professor Eliyahu Rips and Rabbi Glazerson were working on it together, and discovered things that frightened them. So they took it to the high rabbi in Jerusalem and asked him if they could be permitted to work on this production with me, because they just didn't know after getting the results that they'd gotten. They felt it was turning into something serious. But he said, absolutely, you need to do the program. So we've been working together ever since. It's been several years, and you know, then we had a big recession, and we're still trying to put all the funding together to finish this thing, because it's really an amazing project.
You know, one thing I want to add to that is that
back on
I have.
Pardon?
There? Yeah.
Are you there?
We're here.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay,
I'm here.
Great. Go ahead. Finish your questioning there, Mark.
Well, I just wanted to add one thing to it in working with the group, because I'm so used to having come from the computer industry of working with engineers and scientists, and there's always this great reluctance to come public until they've dotted all their I's and crossed all their T's. And so, you know, initially I could see when I first got involved in the project, a little bit of that, which is normal for researchers doing something, especially when a topic like this could evoke so much fear in people. But what really impresses me is how much the researchers are looking at this. And, you know, these are men that this is their livelihoods. This is how they pay the rent, okay? This is how, you know, they're funded for these projects. And they're saying, hey, go out and get the word out and start talking to people, getting this information out. And I am so appreciative of that, because I understand the personal risks that these researchers have to take, you know, being the way science and academics are funded these days. And so these are very brave men in Israel, very brave.
And it's a difficult subject, because you're touching documents that are sacred.
Yes. Yes, you know, and the guys that are doing a lot of touching are secular, you know, New Agers like me. You know, whoa, that takes some guts to let a guy like me get his gloms on it.
Yeah, I'm not going to go there. I tell you what, we're going to let's take a quick audio here, guys, and when we come back, we'll get into the predictions for California. Hang in there.
Nikola Tesla single-handedly changed the world for the benefit of mankind, yet has been rewarded with obscurity. It's time to bring his story out of the shadows and into the light. With his last breath, Nikola gently smiled.
Let the future tell the truth and evaluate each one according to his work and accomplishments. The present is theirs. The future, for which I have really worked, is mine.
Would they only have listened?
Nikola Tesla, an upcoming show in the Night Zone. Watch for the listings on blogtalkradio.com. Welcome to the shadows of the Night Zone. The
ancient Sumerian texts, just in a very broad overview, basically tell us that these Anunnaki came from space and landed on the Earth in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. They began to set up a colony that they called Eden.
Phone lines are now open. 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287. Intended for entertainment and information purposes only. The Night Zone is merely the purveyor of information. You, the audience, shall judge the quality of information offered. We remind all of our listeners, came here at MTOR. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Colin Knight.
And indeed, caveat emptor it is. It is caveat emptor. But with this information tonight, you are pretty well assured that things are copacetic and exactly the way they're supposed to be. Now, we do have a little bit of audio problem with Blog Talk. They're fighting us for the last 30 minutes. But we will continue with this, guys, as far as we can go. So with this new computing power that the researchers around the world have been using, you are seeing more future predictions, I take it. And one of those predictions is part of the teaser of the show was an earthquake in California within the next 30 days. What's shaking, guys? Pardon the pun.
Okay. Let me jump on this first and bring Richard in, because I really initiated this effort. And the reason why is that I was familiar with Drazen's codes on the big one hitting Los Angeles, the San Andreas Pops. And so what happened is that then we started getting reports from sensitives. And sensitives are going to have a physiological premonition. They actually, you know, it's like if there are folks out there that have an old injury and, you know, when rain's coming on, you feel a creak in that bone that you snapped a few years ago, that kind of a thing. Well, sensitives get similar kinds of feelings. Accuracy-wise, I'd say they're a little better than a weatherman or a geologist. But still the same, when you start seeing multiple sensitives reporting these premonitions, which are physical in nature, that's when you start saying, okay, what else have we got going here? And so then what I did was I asked Richard to revisit Drazen's codes with the Torah code team in Jerusalem. He did that, and I was also getting other feedback from other members of the team. L.A. Marzulli told me that he had sensitives reporting that to him, and I'm actually now seeing it popping up on blogs elsewhere, folks that are not following us, but they're just reporting it too. And what you need to put in context here for a Los Angeles event is what we're really talking about is three things here. We have the long term, we have the near term, and then we have short term. Long term is that's the Torah code that we have now that indicates to us that we have a threat of a major event happening between now and the end of this year. Sensitives, which has nothing to do whatsoever with Torah code, are sensing something happening sooner. So I generally, with sensitives, I put it 2 to 4 weeks out. And that's the near forecast. So we have near and long. Now, short term is that's when dogs and cats start to disappear, birds fly off, animals start behaving weird. These are the same kind of things that scissorg.org, the fellow that developed that site, he's a geologist that predicted the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake. Berkman was his name. And he did it by looking at what was happening with cats and dogs taking off. But also there's a geyser, small geyser in Marin County. I've actually been there. And he was using that and changing behavior in the geyser. So what he really says is look for things that are going to change behavior in relationship to an impending quake event. And I think that what your listeners need to do, particularly those of you in California, is that just view this information with a sense of a prudent threshold, all right? And you take your precautions. And you know, normally in California, I live in California, Richard lives in California, and you know, it's the three-day kit with the batteries, the flashlight, a little bit of water. But what I want to say to Los Angelinos is, and for those living in L.A. and within 100 miles of L.A., is make that a 30-day supply. And it doesn't have to be fancy. You can go to your favorite warehouse, all right, and or to a restaurant supply and buy yourself 100 pounds of pinto beans and rice and whatnot, just basic staples, things, peanut butter for protein, inexpensive things for $100, $150. And that'll get your family through for a full month, and you're not going to, you know, have a problem. Because if there's a major quake that happens in Los Angeles, all right, you have a city that is completely artificial in terms of its ability to support itself. If it weren't for water being brought down into L.A., power being brought into L.A., foodstuffs being brought into L.A., L.A. itself has not, it doesn't have the resources to sustain itself. So you're talking
I don't think many cities in North America have those full resources to sustain themselves. It is a major catastrophe. I think all
I
of
agree
those
completely.
You know, yeah.
No,
okay, sorry.
That's true. And L.A. is particularly difficult because it's pretty much a desert city, and so
right.
You know, water and all of those things are always short supply.
Right.
But let me touch upon the original Drosnin table and what happened with the table so we don't run out of time here. The original Drosnin table is found in his book in pages 141 and 142 in the Bible Code book. And basically what we did was remake those. We rebuilt those tables using newer technology. And I got two new tables back from Rabbi Glazerson out of Jerusalem, and he worked with Dr. Rotenberg, which is one of the professors there that's a code writer, software programmer. And so the two of them came up with two new tables, which I thought were really interesting, based on the keywords that were in the Drosnin table. So we have the phrase big earthquake, and the one Drosnin table included the year 1994, which I thought was interesting, which meant that it was half correct, because in 1994 is when everyone remembers out here we had the Northridge quake, and indeed
right.
That was in the Torah code table, and it's in the same table that also says in 5770, which is 2010. So this one table relates that there was an earthquake that indeed occurred in 1994, and it's expecting another one in 2010. And it says California, and then they found the words a threat. Now, the threat is a bit ambiguous. We don't know if there's a threat of an earthquake or we're going to be threatened by an earthquake or what. So that does leave kind of a door for an out in case it doesn't happen. But I just thought it was interesting. The second table is the one Rosalind got more excited about because it uses very minimal skips. He found the phrase in 5770, which is the Hebrew year for 2010. He found it only once in the entire Torah, and it ended up on the same line with the word earthquake. It actually touches the word earthquake on the same line. And then running down the middle of the table is L.A., California. And so that table there is a very small, a cylinder size of only 65, which means it's a significant table. It's very small and packed with information. So those were the two earthquake tables we found on the L.A. earthquake.
Now, what fascinates me is that they had the words California earthquake, L.A., California, those words 3,300 years ago. And
yeah,
yet, you know, they're less than 200, or they're just over 200 years old as names to us. Yet 3,300 years ago, they correctly identified Los Angeles, California.
That's
right.
Correct. It's crazy.
It's not like Nostradamus and Hister is Hitler.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of have to, you know, fudge one into the other. I mean, we're talking about spot-on direct hits here.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think that's an important thing. And you're
and,
right.
And,
yeah. I mean, how would they know that these cities even existed?
Exactly. And a shout out to John Hogue, who comes to the show quite frequently. And I got to say that when John says something is rolling, something's rolling, pay attention, because he's in the groove of Nostradamus. There is no doubt about it in my mind that John Hoag has that groove. And he mentioned regarding 2012 that as we're coming through this new age through the universe, we come into the age of Aquarius. And it's not a matter of ending. It's a matter of a new beginning and a new awareness. Would you would you sound that out? Would that sound out similar to what you're getting?
Yes, because in one of the tables that we did, 2012 tables, it's three or four times in that table was the key word redemption.
Right.
So there is sort of a duality of 2012, of destruction and redemption, which I've always found quite fascinating.
They go hand in hand.
They seem to. And also with the level of consciousness changing during that, and people seem to be changing gradually as we approach that. So all those things also have scientific significance. It's not like we're just imagining all these things, because even NASA tells us that we're being bombarded by unusually energetic cosmic rays. They don't know what that's doing to us. But you can see it if you go to the Science Museum in New York, where they have a cloud chamber. You can actually see these cosmic particles racing through the tank and leaving vapor trails behind them. And there's a few little simple ones that look like dust falling, and then you'll get these things that look like comets that go through the tank, and those are the kind of cosmic rays that we're currently being affected by.
Plus the fact that our heliosphere is collapsing and deforming. And that's our magnetic shield against space weather. So there are a lot of things that are coming together. Torah code is really there, and it's, you know, and I want to share that when I first came to this, when I look at this and I go, this had to be created by an intelligence beyond our own. But what is the motive of this intelligence to give us this information? And I think that the motive is that it is part of the wake-up call to become, to stop slumbering, you know, or going to the mall. That's it. You know, we have this go-to-the-mall existence, but it's rather to be aware of what's happening around us and understand that we must be seeking oneness with everything that is around us, because that's how you see things coming. And that's really what I see the beauty of the Torah code. It is a scientific way for us to have a spiritual journey into oneness.
I have a great example of a code that is one of the most phenomenal occurrences that I've ever experienced as far as what the code has done. And take me a second to relate that, Colin. But you remember when we had the Mumbai massacre back a couple years ago in November, where Islamic terrorists came in through Mumbai and set the hotels on fire and machine gunned the synagogue there and killed the rabbi and his wife. They went in the next day and they found a Torah scroll, and they opened it up and it had a hole in it where the bullets had pierced it. And when they unrolled it, it was in Leviticus, where it talked about two innocent people that were murdered. It's where the bullet tore the hole through. Meanwhile, Professor Rips in Jerusalem and Moshe Katz, another Torah code expert, were already looking up to see if there was a Torah code about the Mumbai massacre. And they tried different keywords, terror, Mumbai, you know, all these different words. And so Professor Rips called down to the rabbi and asked if they would send a JPEG, a screenshot of where the hole, the bullet pierced the Torah. And when he compared that, when it came back up on his computer and they compared it to the codes that they were already creating, their tables that they had created actually physically passed right through where the hole was torn in the Torah. Mm-hmm. And that just blew everyone's mind at that point. Like, what are the chances of something like that happening?
Right. That's just way too freaky, I think. That's just way out there. That's something we can't even comprehend. Yeah, David Copperfield couldn't pull that one off.
No, exactly. It's millions to one, and we have the Torah codes to prove it, and we have the photo of the torn scroll. And just the fact that the bullet went through that particular scripture where it talks about two people being murdered is bad enough, but when the Torah code ends up in the same exact place and bridges the whole. And even, you know, sometimes Torah codes take on graphic conceptions. I mean, when all the words are lined up, they stack in layers, or they line up in parallelisms. And even the shape of the code, one of these codes that the professors found, looked like the shape of the Torah and the Torah, which was just really a little unbelievable. But that's the kind of thing we're getting. Another thing that happened recently was our writer on this project is Dan Gordon, who is a writer for motion pictures. He's done the movie The Assignment with Ben Kingsley and Donald Sutherland. He worked on The Hurricane with Denzel Washington and many other films. And he asked me if I would ask the professors to look his name up in the Torah. And so they found everything about Dan Gordon in the Torah. They said that Dan Gordon, playwright, you know, his father's name, his birth date, the whole thing was on a very small matrix. It was amazing. But then he said, well, where did you find that? And I think it was Robert Herlick, Professor Herlick, that said it was in Deuteronomy chapter 20 is where we found it. And that's rather significant in itself, that it ended up in a small area of the Torah, not scattered all through the entire Torah. And then he said, wait a minute, that sounds familiar. So a few years earlier, see, Dan is also, not very many people know this, but he is a reservist, as a captain in the Israeli military. And he does that when he's not writing movies. He goes over there to help fight for his country. And so a woman had named Robin had done this piece of art with his picture and a few other soldiers, and they were giving it to them, to the fallen soldiers, as a gift. And she had asked one of the rabbis there to put a scripture verse at the bottom. And when he called her to say, what verse was that? It was Deuteronomy chapter 20. It was exactly where his whole Torah table was found about his name, Dan Gordon. So it's stuff like that that is so personal. It's like, why would anyone do that? But it makes it feel, there's times where we've been doing this and the hair stands up on our arms going, wait a minute, this is just like, this is amazing.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, hair stander I had today, guys, just real fast, is that they're going to go and they're going to try and run the blockade again. And according to Jerusalem Post, Turkey is actually going to send out ships and helicopters to escort it. This could be a major confrontation. On top of that, I'm getting this, and then before that, I get a table from Richard. And Richard, I don't know if you want to talk about it, because I know it's still preliminary, and I know the guys don't want to release on stuff that hasn't gone through the vetting process, but given what I'm seeing with right now, the State Department has put travel advisories on going into Israel for Americans. Turkey's getting ready to run, you know, they're going to use their military to go take another run at this. We're coming to a point of possible confrontation. Talk about that table you sent me, Richard.
We've gotten several tables that are really fascinating. We got one on North Korea that says nuclear holocaust on it. It hasn't been run through the system yet. It hasn't been tested for a p-value yet, but we did get that. Today I got two other tables. This is from a code researcher in Florida that works with the team by the name of Barry Rothman. He did one on the ship in Gaza, where they just had the killings there because of the soldiers were being attacked and all of that. We have a table on that. We have another table on the BP oil spill, and that table is very interesting. It reads top kill starting in the book of Leviticus. Another line says, and pour the oil, and with a skip of one, because the way the words ended up in the Torah text, it ended up in the same passage of scripture that actually said, and pour the oil. And then there's the word fail and the word gulf. And then finally, the most dire one that I've gotten, and I'm certainly not going to make any predictions with this because this just came out, but in the book of Deuteronomy, I got a Torah table today from Rabbi Glazerson in Jerusalem that says World War. And 5770, It talks about suicide, which makes me think suicide bombers, Will right. Smite. It talks about Islamic. It has a number of other keywords in there, as well as some plain text that's running right through it. It's a very small matrix for this much information. It's not something that would be easy to get. I mean, so we're all of a sudden overrun with tables. In fact, a couple weeks ago, we got one on the Icelandic volcano. It says the volcano, the cloud covered, the earth opens up its mouth. It says Europe, it says aviation, and then it said 7 days, which I thought was interesting because that's about how long that the airlines were down.
Right.
And, yeah, let me jump in here because I did with L.A. Marzulli, who's working in the project, and he follows this, and he found that this is a spot-on fit for Ezekiel 17. And because what happens is if this second volcano, Kepler, erupts, it's not like the first one. It's going to be an order of magnitude worse, which means you're not going to have northern Europe and parts of North Atlantic that are going to be blocked for air travel. It's going to take out the whole northern hemisphere, which means that the United States Air Force and the Israeli Air Force are both going to be grounded. And in something like that happening, you look at how the technology placements are for Israel's enemies. They're going the missile route. Missiles don't care. They fly through ash just as easy as anything else. So if Katla erupts, the real concern is that it sets up a surprise attack. And think back to World War II. Hitler launched the Battle of the Bulge in the Ardennes when he knew weather would be grounding the Allied air forces. And he was counting on making his breakthrough before the weather cleared. It was fortunate for the Bastards of Bastogne, those guys that were there, that, and they like to call themselves that, that were really tough and hung on. But when the weather broke, that was when the Allied air power could get through, and they decimated the German attack. And right. So what we have here is a setup for another Battle of the Bulge.
Well, they say if wishes were horses, then beggars would ride. We hope to goodness that we are absolutely wrong on all accounts.
Absolutely.
This is not something I'm sure you guys have come to lightly. So I can understand the difficulty of when to release and when to let know, because if you know and you don't do anything with it, you're probably going to feel pretty bad about that, right? And if you do release it and nothing happens, then you're going to have to revalue those codes. But from what I'm hearing from you guys, I got to say, kudos for this whole attempt to get as many people on the wagon as possible regarding this. This Torah Code 2012. Richard, you're the producer of a video with Pinlight, am I correct?
That's correct. I'm actually directing it. It's been something that we've been working on for quite a while. We started this project in the middle of the Great Recession, so it has not been easy to get the thing out the door, but we're working on trying to get it released as soon as we can.
Right. And great. I'm looking forward to it. I've already signed up on the Pinlight site, so hopefully I'll be notified when it's ready to fly, because I definitely want a piece of that one. And Marshall, Planet X forecast with the new Torah codes that have come out regarding Nibiru in 2013. Where do we stand with your publications? Where are we going with those today, sir?
Well, I think that what we're seeing right now is you're looking at the frequency of new eruption events, seismic events on the planet. There are folks that believe that, like the BP oil spill, I know Mitch Batros believes that it's, due to earth changes that are being exacerbated by this incoming flyby of Planet X. And the hard part about it is that, there's a lot of speculation that people have taken sundog photos and making a lot of noise. I see more organized disinformation than anything else. But what we're seeing are the earth signs that we've always been saying would start happening. They're happening now. We're going into 2012. And keep in mind, all right, if we take Planet X and we take the issue of a pole shift and we set them off to the side, all right, now, I know that, NASA, when the 2012 movie came out, publicly said, nothing's going to happen in 2012. Boy, did they lie. Because NASA's own scientists are saying, hey, this solar max is probably going to be the worst in recorded history. And we're talking about we could have a Y-class event comparable. They're comparing what could happen in 2012, and they understate the case dramatically, that they're comparing it to the Great Storm of 1859. Now, when that storm happened in 1859, telegraphs had only been out for a short time. That storm was so powerful, it shorted out telegraphs all across Europe and the United States, set fires all over the place. And in Hawaii, they were seeing the aurora borealis. Okay, so, the skies were red. It terrified people. And if that happened today, that's it. We're back to the steam age.
Well, true. If we get a solar flare that hits us in such a magnitude that it does make our electricity redundant, then mm-hmm. nothing that we know of. I can't think of one single appliance or product nowadays that doesn't have some kind of a computer chip in it. So I do agree with you that if that did happen, then Earth would be at the mercy of nature, and we would go back mm-hmm. to the Stone Age. We would go back to the Stone Age. Now, is the Torah code, I've only got 1 minute left to go, but is the Torah code showing anything of that magnitude, guys? Anything at all?
Yeah, it shows it.
It does,
That's what brought me into the, because they were seeing it, and that's what got Richard to bring me into it, because they were seeing the connections. And so the Torah code's very specific. 2013, Nibiru. I mean, it's an upside-down T, perfect T. They intersect. And I'm sure that if they keep digging, they'll find a lot more. But everything is correlating. And to those people who are saying, I'm going to believe this when I see it with my own eyes, what I would tell you is, fine. But just remember this. If you are not prepared for the consequences, when you do get to see it with your own two eyes, it'll probably be the last thing you see.
Okay, what a way to end the show. Guys, you've been fantastic. Richard, thank you. And Marshall, thank you very much, sir. I appreciate it.
Pleasure to be on. Thanks so much, Colin.
Great show.
Take care, thank you. Take care, Marshall. We'll talk to you another time. Ladies and gentlemen, we're banging through 90 minutes super special about the Torah code in 2012. Whether you believe it, or whether you believe the code's real or not, by the time you see the video that these guys have put together, you'll be convinced that the code really does exist. It's that good. Blessings on your household. Catch you next week.
Hey, Night Zoners, got a minute? I'm sure we all know someone who is experiencing difficult times during this recession, either with unemployment or financial problems, or in relationships. I have friends like that. I would like to remind you that we are all in this together. So if you have friends experiencing hardships, support them with your advice. If you have acquaintances who are having rough times, nurture them with your friendship. Show them kindness. If you have family members who are having difficulties, show them your love. And if you have people in your life who have almost given up, throw them a lifeline of kindness. Remember the golden rule, but for the grace of God, go I. Blessings upon your household. Until then, next time we meet.
This has been a Night Zone production in association with BlogTalkRadio.com.